peacekeeping this year, last year, and even the year before was already a lot smaller than before the liquidity crisis. There's only $5.5 billion today versus a budget that only several years ago was over $8 billion a year.
Welcome to Multilateralism Unpacked, the podcast of United Nations University Center for Policy Research. I'm Jack Dorrell, Head of Communications at UNU-CPR. In today's episode, we're looking at the future of UN peace operations at a moment of real pressure and transition. We're seeing a convergence of challenges, more complex conflicts, tightening budgets and increasing geopolitical fragmentation, all unfolding alongside major reform processes, including UNAIDS. Together, these dynamics are forcing some fundamental questions. What should peace operations do? Where should they operate? And how can they be sustained in the years ahead? To help unpack all of this, I'm joined by Adam Day, the head of UNU-CPR's Geneva office. Adam served for a decade in UN peace operations, including as a senior advisor to the mission in the DRC and in political roles in the Middle East, Sudan, and in New York at UN headquarters. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Adam, welcome.
Thanks so much, Jack. It's great to be here.
So let me start just by stepping back. We often hear about individual pressures on UN peace operations, whether funding, politics, mandates. But what I think feels different now is the convergence of all of these pressures. So how would you define the current moment?
Thanks, Jack. And I think that people are always talking about the end of peacekeeping. And when I served in UNAMID in Darfur, I remember senior leaders then, almost 20 years ago, saying that was going to be the last big peacekeeping mission. 10 years ago, when I was in Eastern Congo working in MONUSCO, we began seriously thinking about downsizing the mission. And there was a whole flurry of activity saying, you know, this might be the beginning of the end of large multidimensional missions. The expulsion of MINUSMA from Mali a few years ago had another kind of flurry of people saying, this is the end of an era. So I think my starting point is, it's easy to say we're at the end of something, and I've even said it recently, but it's much harder to say what we're in the beginning of or what the current moment is, which is kind of your question. And I think there are kind of three things that I would say are true about the current moment. The first one is that the budgetary liquidity crisis is real. The downward pressure is strong. And we can come to what that looks like in a minute. The second thing is that states are beginning to go their own way. If you look at the last couple of years with the US brokered deals for Congo and Gaza, Thailand, there's no mention of the UN. And there are similar dynamics in countries like Mali and CAR, where countries are looking more to bilateral partners like Russia, China, UAE, much more than the UN. And the third thing, I think, which is kind of related to the first two, which is confidence is low. The track record of recent peace operations is not great. It's hard for them to show progress. And the SG himself has said that we need to think more about what their limitations might be. So I think those three things combine to make us feel that we're in a moment of significant change, harder to say exactly what that looks like.
So let's turn to financing first, because I think, you know, this seems to be one of the most immediate constraints on peace operations. How severe is the current funding crisis facing UN peace operations?
So I think it's important to differentiate between a liquidity crisis, which is states not paying their annual payments, which has created some of the relative panic in the past year, versus a funding issue more generally, which would be more like states saying, I don't want to pay for this kind of activity, so please take it out of future budgets. The most immediate issue is the liquidity crisis. And in my view, it's extraordinarily serious. I think there are unpaid contributions of around $2 billion out of a $5.5 billion annual budget. And that means that the UN has had to do so-called contingency planning, which is really just a euphemism for saying cuts. And the cuts are really big. Even in the last few months, something like 25% of troops and police were announced to be cut. And the problem is that these kind of cuts happen very quickly. Troops are withdrawn, field sites are closed. It can create real risks to people on the ground. One of the worst hit places has been South Sudan. Some of our colleagues were there recently. I used to work there. it went from 28 team sites spread all over the country to 18 in just a few months. And some of the work that my colleagues and I have done have showed that physical presence is very directly tied to lower risks of attacks on civilians in many places. So the cuts are having a real effect. I do think there's one final point that's worth noting, is that peacekeeping this year, last year, and even the year before was already a lot smaller than before the liquidity crisis. There's only $5.5 billion today versus a budget that only several years ago was over $8 billion a year. So I would imagine that as we continue to scale down with the mission in Eastern Congo and UNIFIL, it will continue to shrink. But I think that's separate from the very quick cuts that we're seeing as a result of the liquidity crisis.
So, I mean, you're seeing this more as a short-term fiscal squeeze, or do you think this is actually something that's much more structural that's going to define peace operations going forward?
I think that maybe kind of a little bit of both. I think the downward pressure will continue. I would imagine that many states stay in arrears and there will continue to be so-called contingency measures. And some missions will start to more naturally wrap up. So, for example, the mission in southern Lebanon, UNIFIL, it was agreed the end of last year that that mission would phase out over the course of this year. That is not a liquidity crisis issue. That's the Security Council deciding to shut a mission. I think there's a real question about whether that's a good idea right now, given what's happening in southern Lebanon. Similarly, with MONUSCO, for the last 12 years, they've been thinking about and actively shaving away parts of that mission every year. So I think that will continue. But I also think it was worth thinking that who's going to pick up the pieces from some of the new deals and new crises. The US deal between Rwanda and the DRC means somebody has to stay there to help enforce it. Who will be on the ground in Gaza after the ceasefire period is over? So I think that that bigger strategic question is not addressed by the short-term fiscal or financial question that we're dealing with right now.
I also want to just turn to UN reforms as well. You know, we're seeing peace operations now discussed in the context of UNAIDS and broader institutional reform. So how does the UNAIDS process intersect with peace operations? Is this primarily about efficiency and cost cutting, or do you think we're seeing something deeper, a reconsideration of the UN's role in conflict settings?
Well, I wish we were doing the latter, but I think ultimately UNAIDS is first and foremost about surviving the financial shortfall and the cuts that are needed to survive that. There are other priorities, especially around how mandates are made for the UN system. But the main goal of the reform, as it's played out over the past year, has been the question of how to absorb 15 to 20% less money for what we want to do as an organization. So when I look at the contingency planning, the cuts to the secretariat, the small shifts in the location of certain services within the peace and security architecture, like rule of law and security institutions, none of them is really aimed at re-envisioning the role of peace operations. That's much more about how can we move things around and cut things to survive the current moment. And for me, that's not asking the strategic question about what's the utility and value of peace operations in the broader peace and security architecture. But I do think it opens the door to such a conversation. I mean, if member states are demanding that the UN make a clearer value proposition, a clearer articulation of impact to justify spending, then we can start asking that question about what the role of the UN is in conflict settings. And I do think there's a unique and irreplaceable role for the UN in bringing parties together, providing some security guarantee to agreements when no other actor can. I think it's unfortunate that the UNAIDS process hasn't made room for that to happen amongst the membership yet, but I think it's kind of wedged the door open a bit.
We also have a peace operations review that's coming up as well over the next couple of months. This was something that was mentioned in the Secretary General's New Agenda for Peace several years ago. You know, he said in the New Agenda for Peace that he would commission a report on the future of peace operations. When is that review coming out? I mean, we know it's over the next couple of months, but do you know exactly when that's going to be released? And what do you expect from the review?
I think anticipating the release date of a report is just as dangerous as anticipating the direction of peace operations. I've heard the first half of June, and I think much of the report will echo the main messages from the new agenda for peace about what a difficult environment it is, how hard it is to operate in places where there aren't peace agreements. But I think there's also a bit of a zeitgeist moment. I mean, if you look at, and maybe we'll come to this later, but if you look at all five Secretary General candidates, they're all emphasizing peacemaking and mediation. If you look at the US brokered deals over the last year, all of those really have a peacemaking, mediation, conflict resolution function. They're all big geopolitics. And I do think that the focus of the upcoming SG's report will be maybe less about how peace operations can do that kind of end of history state building extension of state authority stuff that has really been bread and butter of peacekeeping for the last 25 years, and more about how we can have that political role for peace operations in all their forms, from the 20,000 troop mission in country that's doing a huge number of state building activities, all the way down to a single envoy. And so I think that the idea of essential peacekeeping, the more bare bones kind of phrase that's being tossed around, is probably going to be implicit in the report. I do think there's a risk in that direction. There's a long track record of key elements of peace operations like human rights, rule of law, and justice playing an important role. But I would guess that there's going to be a bit of a pivot more towards political peacemaking and what can we make of peace operations with that context.
The conversation about the future of peace operations is, also unfolding at a moment when the UN itself is preparing for a transition in leadership. We have the election of a new Secretary General coming up later this year. So how significant could the next Secretary General be in shaping the future direction of UN peace operations?
I mean, the short answer is huge, but I think maybe just thinking about the current SG candidates, I find a striking similarity if you read all of their vision statements of the five current candidates around peace and security. I think there's a kind of uniform sense that the good offices function of the Secretary General needs to be reinvigorated. Again, there's that kind of return to peacemaking and global politics that's inherent across almost all of the vision statements. There's this idea of being much more active without dipping into being an activist. So at a macro level, my sense is that they're all pushing in more or less the same direction, although they're very different people. I don't see very many concrete ideas that show what specific direction any SG candidates might want to go. I noticed that Rebecca Greenspan spoke about her economic background and history with the Black Sea Grain Initiative, so maybe an indication of a more political economy approach there. Maria Fernanda Espinosa, the newest candidate, has a specific proposal around the creation of a prevention platform in EOSG, which could be quite exciting and maybe different. But broadly, I think it's hard to know what from these candidates would be specifically on the peace and security side. I do think that the Secretary General can make an enormous difference by showing up, being persistent, offering ideas and solutions. Kofi Annan did this all the time. Not trying to lead every peace process per se, but constantly being ready, entrepreneurial, showing up and offering. And here I think we have a little bit of a red herring in terms of the role of the Secretary General. When you read the pundits and all the wonks on the UN, everyone's asking what reform ideas the new SG may have. Secretary Generals in general have a very limited scope to do transformational reform. The Secretary General can't even create a new post without going to the General Assembly to ask for one. And I've been arguing for a shift in focus on the ask of the future SG. Let's ask her or him, what are you going to do? Will you show up in the Middle East and offer something concrete on Gaza or Iran or Lebanon? And what might a peace operation on the heels of that look like? Potentially, not necessarily. Will you try a new initiative for Sudan working with the AU? For me, the reform question and the architectural question is actually the least interesting thing to ask an SG because the SG, first of all, doesn't have much authority to do that. But the most interesting question is what type of diplomat in chief is the SG going to be? And how can then the architecture of the system cluster around and follow that initiative or set of initiatives that a new SG might do?
So let me just close by looking forward, and you've touched on some of this previously in your answers, but if you were to take an informed view, what might UN peace operations look like 5 years from now?
Yeah, and it's a difficult question, and it's quite easy to say kind of a lot more of the same. And peace operations operate on a spectrum from one person, a special envoy, to 25,000 people, almost 20,000 troops, 3,000 police, 1,500 civilians. So there's a huge spectrum about what peace operations might look like. Right now, there are relatively few on that right side of the spectrum, those big ones. I would say 5 years from now, there's even less of those very big ones, the UNMISS in South Sudan, the MINUSCA in Central African Republic, the MONUSCO in Eastern Congo. I would imagine there wouldn't be any new big ones like that. There might be more kind of unique and bespoke ones in between. Haiti is a new mission that has a completely unheard of kind of mandate. There's a gang suppression force. There are missions where the UN is kind of supporting the AU in places like Somalia. I would imagine that 5 years from now, we'll see more kind of bespoke partnership-based peace operations where the UN is not even necessarily leading. It's a difficult model. There will be some traditional peace operations, and there are some writers who say that actually going back to basics and having the more traditional kind of ceasefire monitoring missions would be something the UN could do. I could imagine a few more of those. I could imagine, if Hormuz turns into some sort of ceasefire, there could be a role for the UN in building confidence by monitoring that. Maybe not welcome right now, but some of those more traditional models could come back in. There's a great paper by Paul Williams that offers 30 different models of peace operations. We tend to only think about two of them. The big cookie cutter 20,000 troop mission that you see in a lot of places, and the small envoy. I'd be interested to see if more of the exploration of those other models mixing and matching a bit more. Ultimately, the key for the future, the next 5 years of peace operations, is what can the Security Council agree on? And right now, I think there's a tendency for the Security Council to agree to roll over or slightly downsize missions. It would require maybe a bit more energy in the Security Council and cooperation to come up with some of these new models, but Haiti is an example of them being able to do it. So that would be my projection is more weirdness in the middle, slightly less on the big side, and still continuing on with some of those envoy and light positions too.
So thanks for that forward-looking perspective. As a final follow-up question, are there any missions that we should be looking at in terms of how they're going to be affected by the funding crisis and also ongoing reforms? And perhaps you could just explain why we should be looking at those missions to get a sense of how UN peace operations might be evolving over the future, a few years.
Yeah, and I think maybe three and a half are worth really looking at. The first one is UNIFIL, which is a mission in southern Lebanon that's been there since I think 1978. Its mandate has changed over time. After the 2006 war between Israel and Lebanon, its mandate was adapted again to hopefully try to prevent another war. And at the end of last year, the Security Council agreed to shut that mission down. Since that decision, there has been an extraordinary change of circumstances. Israel is now occupying part of southern Lebanon. There's a continuous kind of risk of escalation, a lot of bombs hitting Beirut. And I think there is a sense among some quarters that some sort of transition into something else in southern Lebanon is needed. You can't just shut down and leave at a moment like this. So I would watch that one. It's a very difficult and delicate discussion within the council because any extension of UNIFIL or transformation of UNIFIL into something else would be, to a certain extent, an acknowledgement that there was an ongoing crisis. And certain members of the Security Council may not want to acknowledge that ongoing crisis. But I would watch that one closely, especially over the summer. Summer months tend to be where the action happens, especially in that region. The second one I think is worth watching. And this one may not move as quickly or as dynamically as it has in the past, but Eastern Congo, there was a deal brokered by President Trump over a year ago now, which really was meant to bring Rwanda and Congo into an agreement that would prevent the M23 armed group from posing essentially an existential risk to the government in Eastern Congo. That agreement didn't hold for very long until the fighting started again, but it's kind of triggered a lot of movement and thinking about what the configuration of MONUSCO, the mission in the Congo, needs to be to kind of build on that. And I could imagine that the political initiative by the U.S. creates a bit of energy to rethink how MONUSCO operates there. It is a mission that has been shrinking and shrinking its geographic footprint for years now. It has experienced the contingency planning that I mentioned before. But I think it's a moment that's very important for the entire region. And also it's a mission that's been there since the early 2000s. So a strategic opportunity for the UN to rethink. And the third one is actually a place, and I'll do three and a half, but the third one is a place where we don't have a mission. Sudan has been the worst humanitarian crisis in the world for over a year now. It has had active fighting that has taken over the capital, every major capital in the western part of the country. And essentially the UN has almost nothing on the ground that would resemble a peace operation. It has the resident coordinator as the highest ranking official. There is an envoy, but not an envoy that you would imagine would be called a peace operation with assets in the country. I think that is a strategic mistake by the UN system, by the Security Council, by the African Union. Something needs to be there as a check on the parties. Something needs to be there to support the humanitarian assistance. I think a new SG coming in should prioritize a political process that leads to something. It doesn't have to be a UN peace operation. And you know, UNITAMS, the peace building operation that was on the ground, was expelled. And so I think just throwing another one at that problem is not the answer, but it's the conflict to watch and how the UN organizes itself around that conflict. And then the third one is another one where we don't really have a peace operation per se, but UNSCO is the UN Special Coordinator's Office for the Middle East. That position was vacant for quite a long time after Sigrid Kaag stepped down last year. It is, for me, a shocking absence at a moment of extraordinary upheaval in the Middle East to have the Special Coordinator's Office not be actively supported, not be re-energized. I've done some writing with some colleagues about how a more regional approach to all of the conflicts in the Middle East could re-energize and reframe that that role. I would love to see the new SG come in with a proposal for a kind of super envoy that would shore up the political process and the political support, especially with Gaza, Iran, Straits of Hormuz, southern Lebanon, all of that happening at the same time. I think it's an extraordinary moment that requires a strategic reset for the UN.
Adam, thanks a lot for those insights. It was really interesting, and we'll be checking in later this year to see how things develop with the transition of the new Secretary General and as the funding crisis facing the UN plays out. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jack. It was great to talk to you.
This episode is the first in a broader series exploring the future of UN peace operations. Future episodes will take deeper dives into many of the issues we touched on today, including operational adaptation, financing pressures, and the changing role of multilateral peace operations in an increasingly fragmented global landscape. Until next time.